So we're back here at Syndicated News again, and today we're interviewing John McEwen of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band.
That's me.
Welcome back. So nice to have you here with us.
Like I said to my mom, thanks for having me.
So let's get right to it.
What's on your mind?
Now, John, it's been said, and by too few, that the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band was an equal contributor to the mystic country rock scene of the late 60s and early 70s. What do you think about that?
Well, are you familiar with Burrito Brothers and people like that?
Mm-hmm.
And the Sweetheart of the Rodeo album?
Yes.
Those are great records.
Go on.
If they really believed that country music was viable, because they quit. They did it for a few years and walked away.
Why?
Now, I don't know why. I never listened to their music. We had our own influences. We were recording. I'm very proud of the fact that the Eagles said in a couple of early interviews that, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band was a big influence on us. And I don't know exactly how, but I'm glad they said it. But the Dirt Band continued to the point where we risked our entire career making Will the Circle Be Unbroken, an acoustic traditional country album that right after we had two pop hits, American Dream in 79 and Make a Little Magic, that are considered classic rock, we went quote unquote country. And our first number one record was in around 1982 with Long Hard Road, a Rodney Crowell song. And for the next 6-7 years, we had 17 country radio hits. We were on the Grand Ole Opry. We were on the country tour in Europe with Johnny Cash and Merle Haggard and people like that. We were a bunch of hippies using banjo, fiddle, guitar, mandolin, harmonica. And I just think the Dirt Band deserves more credit for that. And I think part of the problem is the name, Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. Sounds kind of like 1910 Fruit Gum Company or something. But I'm proud of our accomplishments. I'm not whining about that. I'm just saying that we have a star on the walk in Nashville, and they chose to put it next to Hank Williams Sr. My God, the country industry and the people that vote for that kind of thing saw something, but not very many of the Rolling Stone type of people. Although Rolling Stone did say about the Circle Be Unbroken album, one of the most important records to come out of Nashville.
And John, of the many times you thought you were recording a hit, how many times were you right?
Well, that's a weird thing, Ruth, because people always like to think they're recording hits. bands don't make hit records. They record songs and the audience makes them hits. Somehow the magic combination of stuff happens. They call in, they tell their friends about something they heard, a writer loves it right at the right time when somebody might play it. But there are times, like when we were the group that played the music for my friend Steve Martin, who my brother was managing for King Tut, we knew King Tut was going to be a smash. When we recorded Bojangles, we really felt like we knew a lot of people are going to like this song. The minute I started hearing playing my guitar and detuning, and we're in the studio and he was doing a live vocal, oh my God, I feel like I'm listening to the radio right now. There's been about 5 or 6 times that that's happened. And there's been a couple other times when I thought it could be a hit, or this should be, but nothing. Didn't go anywhere. For whatever reasons, just didn't go anywhere.
Do you think it's harder or easier to get new music out nowadays, or is it possibly easier because of the technology?
It's easier to get it out. It's harder to get attention. In the days of L.A. and the music scene I grew up in, KHJ, Channel 90, whatever, we just heard Aretha Franklin coming up as Counting Flowers on the Wall, and pretty soon we got a new Beatles cut. But first, here's Joan Baez, and this was pop radio, the number one station.
Yes.
Okay, it was harder to get through the filter that puts you in that, but you sure covered a lot more people and you got them all at once. And now there's 1,100 stations saying, here's the pre-1950 bluegrass traditional station. Or you're listening to the Jewish Vietnamese hour. I mean, it's just so hard. It's harder to get the attention of an audience because there's thousands of billboards on the freeway.
Now, with recordings being made and replicated and reproduced digitally, what do you think the younger generation might be missing because of it?
They're missing a broader spectrum of sound. It's like they're looking at the Mona Lisa through a pair of sunglasses and go like, wow, what colors? Still good painting. It's like you go to see The Last Supper, but you've got glasses on that only show you nine people at the table. Still a great painting. Hey.
I love your analogies.
Thank you. I appreciate that. They just popped up. It's a strange thing because analog really does sound wonderful. Digital, you give up a lot of sound. But with the older audience, over 45, you've lost 10% of your hearing anyway. And it's so much easier to move an MP3 around. But MP3 sounds worse than CD. But the machines that you use to reproduce them, I'll just pop my iPhone into my little automatic holder that has a 4-inch speaker next to it and one across the room somewhere, and you hear it, but you're not hearing all of it. So a combination. Digital helps get the information out there and maneuver it and manipulate it, but it also has opened up the playing field to where it's just massive. It's like having 100 quarterbacks on the football field, and they're all good, maybe, but which one do you hike to?
I enjoy it when I'm talking to someone about one topic or another and they use football references. I'm from Manhattan. I know nothing about football. Nothing. Nothing.
Well, they get 2 points every time you get the basket at the end of the field, right?
Basket. I thought it was basketball. But in any case, I digress. Of the few proudest moments, however many they were, as far as a time when you knew it would be tough. And the band pulled through, and you came out on top. Give me some examples.
Got time for two?
Okay.
Do you?
Yeah.
I'll go to one.
Yeah.
We did 12 shows with Bobby Sherman. Julie, 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 do you love me? The first two shows, the teeny boppers hated us. We had to figure out how to get to this audience, because you don't want to do the other 10 shows sucking, right?
Mm-hmm.
We figured it out. By the first song, how many are here to see Bobby Sherman? Scream, scream, scream. Come on, you got to scream louder than that if you want him to hear you. Scream, scream, scream. You got your flashbulbs ready? Yes. Okay, here's another song. The next song. Okay, we got to make sure those flashbulbs are working. On the count of three, get ready. We're going to test them. One.
Is that right?
Two, three. You know what 4,000 flashbulbs going off at once looks like? Everybody would scream because it was so much fun. And here's another song. Oh, and the next song would be like, Bobby's told us that we should play this next song for you because he thinks you'll like it. Anything we could think of. We ended up getting encores, and then we worried, oh, my God, the Bobby Sherman audience likes us. But we were glad. Huh?
I thought that's what you wanted.
Well, we did, but then we couldn't go home telling people, how was the Bobby Sherman tour? Oh, they loved us, those 14-year-olds. It was a different time. We were hip. We were supposed to be. But Bobby was really cool. Bobby, does it bother you? The girls scream all the way through your set. Ah! And he'd start a song, Julie, Julie. Ah! It would go down to a certain level. And he told me in Hartford, Connecticut, it doesn't bother me because I know something they don't. And I said, what's that? He says, I can't sing. And when they stop screaming, they'll find out. And I figure I've got about a year and a half.
Is that right?
Yeah, now he's an EMT in L.A.
Are you serious?
Yeah, 5 years ago he was. But
wow.
Version into situation two?
Yes, please.
That was a Bobby Sherman incident. And then let's go ahead about 25 years, because this band's been together more than any four bands you can add up, usually.
Mm-hmm.
45th year of Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. And we're in the 90s. We're on a 12-act tour in Europe. It's like 10 cities, Frankfurt, you know, Wembley Arena, stuff like that. Well, the last date was Switzerland, Geneva, big 12,000-seat auditorium. Our turn, which we were going on just before Johnny Cash, was coming up, and we're heading to the stage, and I noticed the entire cast, from Bill Monroe to Johnny Russell to, I think, Crystal Gayle was on that show, and her band, everybody's walking out to the stage. And I say to Johnny Russell, who wrote I Got a Tiger by the Tail and all kinds of great songs, Johnny, what's going on? Why is everybody... Well, John, none of us have gotten to these people today, and we figure if you guys don't, it wasn't our fault. And these people were going out to watch us crucify ourselves. It felt like everybody was waiting for Johnny Cash. Well, the first three or four songs were a little bit quiet in response. But the next song, when I said, I grew up in Orange County, and I wasn't weird playing the banjo. I had an East German Shepherd. Well, the audience in Switzerland speaks English. I had an East German Shepherd. It kept people in my yard, and the people just cracked up. And this song is one of our biggest hits, Bojangles. The next song, we got into the Cajun music. Jimmy started chasing me around, and I chased him around on stage. I'm up on a speaker cabinet. The next song was Battle of New Orleans. This is when the British tried to kick American ass, you know, and in my first fiddle solo, I come running out from behind the drum riser with a British flag on. And then the second solo, I'd ripped off the British flag shirt and the American flag. And people were cheering every time something like that. With a third solo, I come out, I've got the Swiss flag on.
Oh.
And the people went nuts. So then I jumped out in the audience, took my shoes off and threw them over their heads. And he started Diggy Diggy Low, and people were on their feet. And when that, I almost want to cry over this. When those people from the Grand Ole Opry world said to us, "You boys did it tonight. Good job." It was just, it was really fun. I mean, we just wanted to make it work. I mean, you know, we didn't, we just wanted to make it work.
What memories.
Yeah. So it was really fun. Then Bill Monroe came to the club that night. I invited him to sit in. That was really fun. I put together a jam session at a Geneva club about 12:30 at night. I see that white hat coming in with a really beautiful Switzerland girl on each arm. The two of them added together. If you added their ages together, it wouldn't have been as much as he was old.
So tell me two things, something you like and something you don't about touring. Tell me.
I like almost any situation where you can go on in front of people and feel like you made them forget where they were for a while because they liked being where you were taking them. And at the same time, they're taking me somewhere. So when I play solo, I don't do the same thing twice. I have certain songs, the order changes, but I always try to play at least one song in a set that I haven't played before in front of people or something different. And when I can get into that space, it's really fun. It's more fun than sitting at home. I don't sit at home and play the songs and go, "Okay, here's one. You're probably going to take, oh, there's nobody here." Sit in front of a mirror and say, "This will take me back." I do this for the audience. I work for them because I don't have a job. I mean, I wake up in the morning and I don't have to go to work. And when the concerts show up, I call it playing. So that's one thing I really like. As far as don't like, usually the only things I don't like are when there's something weird that impinges upon somebody being in that audience not having good sound or good lights or the bathrooms are wrong or the poor promotion or something like that. And the other thing is the crying babies on an airplane. I've raised six kids. They didn't make noise in public. If they did, I took them home. We left two restaurants and it only took two. So
you were very considerate.
Well, I don't like screaming kids in a restaurant or even whining ones. I don't like to hear, "Mommy, mommy, mommy, he's touching me," at all.
And that's quite common. I took a Virgin Air flight from New York City to London, and I didn't know that there were only several places where you could place a child in a bassinet. And they were in the seats that we had chosen. So we wound up having to fly from New York to London with someone else's child in basically our lap because they pull it down. And I was just so surprised and so disappointed.
The other stuff about, you know, people say, "Oh, it's really tough to travel." Or I do believe the journey is a major part of the destination overall. I like getting there. I never missed a job. Over 8,000 shows, I think, at least.
45 and years and 8,000 shows and you've never missed a job?
Well, there have been some shows that were canceled, but that was because
that's beyond your control. That's not
4 feet of snow had dumped on the town, and there was no power.
Yeah.
But I was there. I was there. I was there.
So why are you doing this?
It's something that I know how to do, and I have people tell me it was sure good that you came here because when my brother died, that record you made was played at his funeral.
Oh,
or it was sure good you came here because we got married to that song. Or it's sure good that you came here because my dad hasn't laughed that hard in 2 years.
Oh, my gosh.
It's like a responsibility. If I can do this, then I should as much as possible.
What advice would you give to newcomers, new musicians that have never done business before, that are coming into the industry? What advice would you give them?
Get out now.
No, come on. Give
I would say, read Hunter Thompson's quote about the music business. A long and narrow plastic hallway full of pimps and thieves where good men die like dogs. There's also a negative side.
That was the positive?
And then I would say, keep in mind that if you're going to make a deal with any company, that they have lawyers to keep as much money as possible for them, not you. Keep in mind that you have to be as smart as a farmer who knows what crop to plant, where to plant, when to plant, and when he harvests it, he knows what his market is. I know so many bands that go, okay, man, we've been together 4 years, and we just finished an album, and Is anybody listening? No, we better take this somewhere. If you're not ready for that, by the time you get that album placed, it will already be a year and a half old.
Oh, my. So there's a lot of work to be done.
The first thing I say, oh, you got a band and you're going to make a recording? Start the artwork. Well, we got to do the music. Now, start the art. You wanted advice. Start the artwork. Well, why is that, man? Because 99% of the time, what will slow down a release is the artwork not being ready. We got the album finished. We're going to put it out first week of August, because if we try to put it out in September, we won't have a chance. That's when all the old guns fire and all the special packages start getting shipped for Christmas. So we got to get it out in August. What? Are the cover's not done? Oh, you don't have all the copy for the song rights? Oh, we don't have a barcode? We can't put it out till the end of September, and nobody's going to want it because they don't want to compete with the whole Christmas season. When do we put it out? January? No, because that's too soon. February? Okay. You're already a half a year behind because you didn't start the artwork.
That's amazing. That's great advice.
Thank you.
I had no idea. The artwork. The final
piece of advice is buy the book, Songwriter's Guide to Music Publishing. Songwriter's Guide to Music Publishing by Randy Poe, P-O-E. It is the best definitive guide to where the income stream comes for music that has been freshly, newly created, original music. If you don't have that, then you're just kidding yourself. I don't need that. I can just write the song. Oh, yeah. Well, somebody else will get the money.
Well, about the artwork, I can't tell you how many times I've spoken to a musician or a publicist that can't interview because they can't come to me with something as silly, and I didn't give it much importance until I just heard you say it. It's almost always their art isn't ready.
Right.
I've heard it so many times.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's great advice.
And if you don't get the right release window, you'll kill your album. You don't put out an album October 30th, or unless it's a Halloween hit or something, and you can smother the country all at once. You don't put it out in certain months at certain times. And so there's 4 months that are viable for a new release.
What are those 4 months?
That's an opinion of different people. I would say the third week of January through the end of February, possibly the end of April through May, so you can get the summer rush. And then not July, because everybody that's done this April, May release is all going to be on top of you, taking up the limited amount of space there is to talk about things. And then maybe early August, just before the rush of mid-September that's getting the Christmas stuff out there. And then one of the other ones is September 15 to October 15 for the Christmas-oriented product. And if you don't have a repackage of your greatest hits and a special blah, blah, blah that's going to be offered in that regard, you're going to be going up against the box set of Fleetwood Mac and all that other stuff. And Jewel decides to go orchestral, or, you know, everything. It's the Christmas packages. So that's, in my opinion, that's about it.
Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to share all that with us. I'm sure new musicians are going to get a new earful from you, because it's absolutely right about the artwork. I've heard that 1,000 times, and I didn't know about the windows, and that's very important.
You ought to read my book. It's the best one on publishing, and he was right. Okay.
Anything else you want us to play?
Acoustic Traveler is a good example of, I need one more song. Oh, well, I'm not going to go to sleep till I finish this song, this instrumental. So finally at 1 in the morning, I finish. I take it in the studio the next day. I says, oh, and let's throw this in there. I don't know if it's any good or not. And it comes out being a lot of people's favorite thing. That Acoustic Traveler is the favorite thing I've ever heard you do. My favorite thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Don't judge your own material. Is the comp I make there.
Excellent.
It's, so many songwriters go, oh, this, I'm just going to stick it on the album, and it's the acoustic hit that gives the group a career, or it's the one that turns into something that they didn't expect.
This is just marvelous. I can't thank you enough for the time. This has been John McEwen here at syndicatednews.net, and we're going to close with Acoustic Traveler.
On Vanguard Records.
Thank you so much, John.
Well, thank you.